Today is the first day of this June 2013 six-day Sesshin, and our text for this Sesshin is going to be Tracing Back the Radiance, Chinnell's Korean Way of Zen by Robert E. Buswell, Jr. And this morning we are going to start off with some biographical material. There's just a little bit of background about the age into which Master Chinnell was born. He was born in the Koryo dynasty, and it was a time when Buddhism was very much entrenched in the political structure and the social makeup of the kingdom. Buddhism had very cozy relationships with the court, and the monasteries were very rich, full of expensive figures, many monks. And the church, the Buddhist church, wielded a lot of economic and political power. They owned vast tracts of land and employed thousands of agricultural workers to farm it. Buswell also says that the monasteries at this time were big commercial centres. Some of them were engaged in different kinds of businesses, including distilling spirits, noodle making, and tea production. And the monks also were exempt from military service and corvée labor. That's labor that you have to do on demand by the rulers and for things like road building or other public works. And they even had a kind of parallel system of exams within the Sangha so that ambitious monks could work their way up through the hierarchy. And Buswell writes that this almost inevitably it was this very success which created the most problems for the church. Although the examination system for monks raised the general scholastic level of the Sangha as a whole, it emasculated the spiritual essence of Buddhism by bringing about a preoccupation with secular pursuits. Furthermore, officials in the civil bureaucracy who recognized the influence of the church over the higher echelons of government also used the religion for private gain. Korean Buddhism of the 11th and 12th centuries was increasingly exploited by people both inside and outside the church. As the years progressed, the ranks of the monks were swelled by people pursuing wealth and position on the one hand and avoiding the hardships of the peasant life and the dangers of military service on the other. The influx of persons with less than the holiest of motivations added to the gradual decline of the religion and led to a backlash from the authorities. We don't need to go into what that backlash was in detail, but basically the king started to limit the power of the Sangha in various ways. Chinnell, when he was later on, when he was a monk, he reacted very strongly to this corrupted institution that he was a part of. He was to write, "When we examine the inclination of our conduct from dawn to dusk, we see that we rely on the Buddha Dharma while adorning ourselves with the signs of self and person. Infatuated with material welfare and submerged in secular concerns, we do not cultivate virtue, but only waste food and clothing. Although we have left home, what merit does it have? How sad! We want to leave the triple world, but we do not practice freeing ourselves from sensual objects. Our male body is used in vain, for we lack a man's will. From one standpoint, we fail in the Dharma's propagation. From another, we are negligent in benefiting sentient beings. And between these two, we turn our backs on our four benefactors. These are a traditional way of talking about benefactors: the ruler, the teachers, parents and friends. This is indeed shameful. All this has made me lament since long ago. He was to go on to attempt to reform the Son school, which is the Korean name for the Zen school. He was born in 1158. This was also a very volatile period in history. There were various invasions that caused a lot of havoc. The leadership was demoralized, and there were lots of intrigues and factions in the court, coups, a revolt against the royal family. And so it was a time of instability. He was born into the gentry class, and his father was an administrator at the Royal Academy. But Chinnal from birth was quite weak. He was plagued by serious illnesses, and after many attempts to cure their son by means of the conventional medicine of the time, his parents became quite desperate, and they decided to pray to the Buddhas, and they vowed that if their son were cured of his illnesses, they'd have him ordained. And we're told that soon after this, the illnesses vanished. And his father went on to keep his promise and had his son's head shaved at the age of 7, and then he took the precepts when he was 15, and it was at that point that he was given the Dharma name of Chinnal. Actually, this detail of his biography appears quite often in the tales of the masters, this growing up sickly and making promises to the Buddhas. So as it's a pretty common motif, it may be something that gets added to the story sort of after the fact, perhaps a way of pointing to the healing power of the Dharma, or the strong affinity that the masters have with the homeless life, with becoming a monk. Or it could have actually happened. We don't know. With all this stuff, we don't know what actually happened. We have to rely on these reports. But it is admirable that parents would do this, that they would put the well-being of the child first, because surely no parent wants to say goodbye to a son or a daughter. But the father kept his promise, and he sent his his son off to a monastery. Boswell relates that he didn't seem to have a particularly strong relationship with his preceptor, the monk who ordained him, and that his inclination was very much towards solitude and retreat. And certainly he didn't have any inclination to sort of engage in the politics of the temple. And as there was, it seems, there was somewhat of a lack of instruction from those senior to him in the temple. He relied a lot on reading the scriptures and learning from them. And this was to become a feature of his teaching throughout his life, which was unusual for somebody from the Son school, where there was generally an emphasis on the teaching outside of the scriptures. After he'd been at this first monastery where he was ordained for 9 years, he went to the capital to take the Sangha examinations, and he passed all the tests but became ever more disgusted with the kind of worldly climate surrounding these exams. And it was at this point that he decided to sidestep all of this corruption and worldliness. And others gathered with him in this, and they made a pact that they were going to form a retreat society. Here's what he said in his earliest work about this. This was composed later. One day I made a pact with more than 10 fellow meditators, which said, after the close of this convocation, we will renounce fame and profit and remain in seclusion in the mountain forests. We will form a community designed to foster constant training in samadhi and prajna. Through worship of the Buddha, recitation of sutras, and even through common work, we will each discharge the duties to which we are assigned and nourish the self-nature in all situations. We vow to pass our whole lives free of entanglements and to follow the higher pursuits of accomplished and true men. Would this not be wonderful? All those present who heard these words agreed with what was said and vowed, on another day we will consummate this agreement, live in seclusion in the forest, and be bound together as a community which should be named for samadhi and prajna. Let's have a look at some things that are said in this passage. They start off by saying, we will renounce fame and profit. We'll renounce fame and profit and remain in seclusion in the mountain forests. We can take this renouncing fame and profit as a shorthand for renouncing worldly pursuits, all worldly pursuits. There's a teaching in Buddhism of the eight worldly winds. things that can mislead us, take us down dead ends. And the eight are as follows: fear of blame or ridicule, and desire for praise; fear of pain, desire for pleasure; a fear of ill repute, rejection by one's peers, and desire for fame or adulation; fear of loss, and desire for gain. With all of these, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment if we get caught up in these things. Because of the iron law of impermanence, even if we manage to get into a situation where everybody admires us, or whether we create the perfect environment in which everything is comfortable, it's just not going to last. Sooner or later, it'll fall apart. And these two go together, the fear and the desire, the duo, two sides of one coin, really. All of these things, all of these desires, praise, pleasure, fame, gain, can sum them all up in fear of what is unpleasant, desire for what is pleasant. And we go one step further. It's not just that we have these fears and desires, but that we imagine that our happiness is dependent on getting what is pleasant, or holding on to it and avoiding what is unpleasant. This is the essence of samsara. Up and down, as circumstances change. The attitude of someone who is practicing the Buddha Dharma is completely different from this. Rather than trying to get rid of or avoid suffering, we can learn to use it. In the Tibetan tradition, there's a phrase, transforming adversities into the path of awakening. In other words, valuing the adversities that come up. So not only are these desires problematic because of impermanence, but also because they're misguided. Comfort, fame, praise, gain, all these things are traps. And their opposites, which we so often try and avoid and fear, can be brimful of treasure. if we can learn to work skillfully with them, and Sishin is the perfect place to learn this. One Tibetan teacher once said, "No one has ever attained enlightenment during the course of an easy and comfortable life." To seek enlightenment is to encounter difficulties. It's to struggle with our demons. Sooner or later. The beauty of koans in particular is that they're like the sand and the oyster, that thing that gives rise, that grating thing that gives rise to the pearl. Uncomfortable, sometimes acutely so, but if we persist, that irritation can give rise to so many virtues: patience, forbearance, courage, persistence, humility. Our big problem is that we think we should be somewhere other than where we are. If we can drop that idea of making progress, of seeking those tangible benefits, then everything can turn around. All of this is contained in those few words of Chinul's: "We will renounce fame and profit." We will renounce fame and profit and remain in seclusion in the mountain forests. The essential thing is the renunciation, but withdrawing into the forest helps that renunciation. There are fewer triggers far from the centers of power that can hook us and arouse those eight worldly winds. All over the world, forests are disappearing. It's good to remember that forests have not only been sanctuaries for all kinds of animals, birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, insects, so forth. Not only for animals, but also for millennia for human beings seeking enlightenment. We're so fortunate to have this Zendo encircled by trees these trees around us are really a testament to the power of regeneration. When Ralph Chapin, who donated this property, was alive, there was a photograph in his house taken around 1900 or maybe 1910, and it's a photo of bare, denuded hills, a wasteland, really. They were cleared for farming. The farming didn't work out, and slowly the woods grew back, and we have these beautiful, almost all of the woods around us are regenerated. It's a reminder of what's possible if things are left to their own devices. Just as our minds can heal if we really leave them alone, if we let our thoughts be, if we don't add extraneous pollutants. This is really the principle behind breath practice and shikantaza. To let things be. Chinnell says in this passage, we will form a community designed to foster constant training in samadhi and prajna. Samadhi literally means establish or make firm. Samadhi is the calming of our mental busyness and then the gathering of all our attention onto a single point. But non-dualistically, so we think of a subject and object if we think about our attention being on something. But it's going further than that. We talk about becoming one with the breath, the koan, complete absorption. And then prajna is wisdom, but particularly, at least in our school, intuitive wisdom, especially insight into emptiness, into the no-thingness of things. And it arises out of this one-pointed investigation of one's mind, our own mind. So the establishing or making firm of samadhi comes first, and then we can use that single-pointedness to delve into the mind. But even though they made this group of meditators made this pact, it was a number of years before they were able to actually realize it. And it's not entirely clear what the difficulties were, but all kinds of difficulties arose in their trying to come together as a group, and they got scattered throughout a number of different monasteries. And again, there were things happening politically in the general society that were made their gathering together difficult. State of turmoil, basically, of slave revolts and other things, so that finding an isolated mountain site was difficult and dangerous. And again, we can be grateful that we live in a relatively peaceful society, and also remind ourselves that sooner or later that will change. That's inevitable. We tend to have this delusion that that things are going to stay the same. So it's just a matter of us making the most of living in a peaceful place, relatively peaceful place. It was in this period that Chinnell had a first of a series of awakenings, which were to profoundly affect his whole way of practicing, his attitude towards practice. And there's an account of this on his memorial stele. Those of you who've been to China will have seen these big slabs of stone with covered in Chinese characters, which are used to teach people who come by, pilgrims and others, about the masters, about their lives. And this is the account that appears on this stele. By chance, one day in the study hall, he was looking through the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch. He came across a passage which said, "The self-nature of suchness gives rise to thoughts. But even though the six sense faculties see, hear, sense, and know, it is not tainted by the myriads of images. The true nature is constantly free and self-reliant." Astonished, he was overjoyed at gaining what he had never experienced before, and getting up, he walked around the hall, reflecting on the passage while continuing to recite it. His heart was satisfied. From that time on, his mind was averse to fame and profit. He desired only to dwell in seclusion in the mountain ravines. Bearing hardship joyfully, he aspired to the path, and he was obsessed with this quest. It is recounted in many stories, masters coming to awakening on reading a passage from the sutras or hearing the sutras. For example, sixth ancestor Hui Neng heard the Diamond Sutra being recited. Master Hakuin's, one of his awakenings was on reading. What matters is the ripeness of the mind. But any of the senses can be the doorway to this waking up. And this passage here that was to be the trigger for his awakening. The self nature of suchness gives rise to thoughts, but even though the six sense faculties see, hear, sense, and known, it, that means the self nature, is not tainted by the myriads of images. The true nature is constantly free and self-reliant. This is an important point, and one that if we can remind ourselves of when our mind is full of thoughts, it can be very helpful to have faith that our true nature is never tainted by our thoughts. That's the characteristic of true nature, is its mirror-like quality. It reflects what arises, but is not in any way sullied by what arises. And that's not just sometimes, but always. But what is that like, to keep seeking for a direct experience of that untainted truth? Basel writes, this experience was Chinnell's true initiation into Buddhism. And really that's what a Kensho is. It's an initiation, an entering into. In all his future writings, Chinnell would stress the need for an initial awakening to the mind nature to ensure the consistent development of practice. Subsequent readings of the Platform Sutra, as well as the influence of Tsungmi's writings, spelled out the need to support the initial awakening to the mind nature with the simultaneous cultivation of samadhi and prajna, and the concurrent development of alertness and calmness of a mind. It's a very important point, and this will be a theme through, as we will hear, through the teachings of Master Chinnell. That if we don't continually cultivate samadhi and prajna, then our insights can become mere memories. And we can also say that the more we have cultivated samadhi prior to Kensho, the more fully that Kensho will be able to be realized in our life. But whichever way it goes, whichever comes first, the work continues after Kensho. We continue to cultivate. Why? Because the mind is so deep and wide and vast. As long as our understanding is short of complete understanding, then there's work to do. And complete understanding means understanding that permeates everything we do and say and apprehend. Later on, Chinul had a second awakening. This one really came out of this deep desire he had to bring together the teachings of Zen, of the Son school, and those of the schools based on sutras. Perhaps because he had had this first experience as a result of reading a sutra, this became a real quest for him. And he wanted to find the evidence that both the Son and the scripture schools were in fact one. And he found it. He was reading a commentary to the Avatamsaka Sutra, and he came across a particular passage which he felt did this. He was constantly he was in retreat, and he was constantly reflecting on the Zen saying, "Mind is Buddha." He writes, "I felt that if a person were not fortunate enough to meet with this approach, he would end up wasting many kalpas in vain and would never reach the domain of sanctity. I had always had doubts about the approach to entering into awakening in the Huaom teachings." And this is the Hua Yen school, the school based on the teachings of the Avatamsaka Sutra. What, finally, did it involve? So he's trying to bring these two schools, the Son school and the Hua Yen school, together. "Accordingly, I decided to question a Hua Yen lecturer. He replied, 'You must contemplate the unimpeded interpenetration of all phenomena.' He entreated me further, 'If you merely contemplate your own mind and do not contemplate the unimpeded interfusion of all phenomena, you will never gain the perfect qualities of the fruition of Buddhahood.' I did not answer, but I thought silently to myself, 'If you use the mind to contemplate phenomena, those phenomena will become impediments, and you will have needlessly disturbed your own mind. When will there ever be an end to this situation? But if the mind is brightened and your wisdom purified, then one hair in all the universe will be interfused, for there is perforce nothing which is outside the mind.' I then retired to the mountains and sat reading through the Tripitaka in search of a passage which would confirm the mind doctrine of Son. 3 winters and summers passed before I came upon the simile about one dust mote contains thousands of volumes of sutras." This appears in the Avatamsaka Sutra. And then later in the same passage, he read, "The wisdom of the Tathagatas is just like this. It is complete in the bodies of all sentient beings. It is merely all those ordinary foolish people who were not aware of it and do not recognize it. I put the sutra volume on my head in reverence and unwittingly began to weep. So he wasn't just reading this passage in a casual way. He'd been searching for it for 3 years. And when he found it, it pierced him. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.